Meine Damen und Herren, das war bislang ein langer Tag, aber deswegen haben wir einen Abendredner, der uns alle was sehr Interessantes erzählen wird. Wenn bei dem Namen von Stephen Mitchell Exeter und Humboldt-Universität zu Berlin steht, freue ich mich besonders. Der Stephen Mitchell ist ja inzwischen nach Berlin umgezogen und wird immer mehr zu einem Berliner. Die University of Exeter war sehr, sehr lange seine Wirkungsstätte, wo er von 2002 bis 2011 als Leverhulme Professor of Hellenistic Culture wirkte, Fellow of the British Academy, 2006 Ehrendoktor wurde der Humboldt-Universität zu Berlin für sein großes Buch Anatolia, was ja die Tradition von Harnack auf eine große Weise fortschrieb, um die Expansion of Christianity zu behandeln. Bei Topoi war er von Anfang an dabei. Sie werden auch, abgesehen von Anatolia, Land, Men and Gods in Asia Minor, sein History of the Later Roman Empire kennen, wo eine zweite Auflage bald erscheinen wird. Und dann natürlich die viele Bände zur Epigraphik von Kleinasien, wodurch wir ihn kennengelernt haben. Also in dem ECAM-Projekt selber hat er die Verantwortung für Phrygien übernommen. Das ist ja wahrscheinlich der größte Brocken und wird heute Abend hier reden über Identity and Authority among the early Christians of Phrygia. Stephen, we look forward to your lecture.
Thank you, Célie, for this kind introduction and, of course, for the invitation to this conference, a chance to meet many old friends again and make some new ones equally valuable. It's been a long day, and I've been tasked with delivering the final lecture, which is always a slightly ambiguous privilege to hold. I proposed, and perhaps we shall see how it goes in this lecture, I have a written script in front of me, but we used to have the habit in Exeter, where I taught for 10 years, lecturers or seminarists were asked if they could divide their lecture into three parts, and you'd make a slight pause after each part and allow questions to come in at that point. And this may work on this occasion because my lecture does fall into three parts. And so at the end of the first one, I shall probably pause and ask for reactions. But if we do so, we obviously can't delay too long over questions at that point because we'll need to get to a conclusion before everybody collapses with exhaustion, including myself. Authority and identity in early Christian Phrygia. As is well known, Phrygia is exceptionally rich in epigraphic evidence for early Christianity, with over 800 texts in the ECAM database, the earliest of these dating to the mid-second century. Conversely, the early Christian written tradition throws little light on Phrygian Christianity, leaving aside the largely hostile literature about the Montanists. One substantial exception to that generalization, the relatively rich literary sources, beginning with Paul's letter to the Colossians that concern the communities of the Lycus Valley, which have been comprehensively examined in their regional context by Ulrich Huttner. However, that was a borderline part of Phrygia, in a sense, culturally aligned with the large cities of the Meander Valley, rather than with the agricultural hinterland of small towns, villages, and imperial estates of the Phrygian hinterland. As I think everybody is aware, study on Asia Minor has become part of the scholarly mainstream, I think, in the last 50 years, probably particularly in Germany. rather than a sort of ancient historical bywater for specialists only. And one of the consequences of that development is that the region's significance for early Christian history has once more come back into focus. The work of Ramsay, with all its faults and eccentricities, has made a triumphant comeback. But even when we recognise that the documentary evidence for Christianity from Phrygia, Lycaonia, and other parts of central Anatolia is rich and abundant from an early date, there are big questions that need to be answered. Above all, we need both to have some idea what this documentary evidence really means, what sort of reality does it reflect, and then we need to seek explanations of why this should be so. Why does it exist in the way that it does? What is it telling us? And why did Christianity, as it seems, become the majority religion here at such an early date? Well, the conference organisers, or maybe the topoi funders, as we learnt this morning, have given us two ideas to work with in trying to find answers to these questions: authority and identity. And neither term is an easy one to grasp, although both have repeatedly pressed into scholarly service as Ansatzpunkte for research questions. The problem, of course, is that both terms are vague and ambiguous. I mean, that's both their advantage as well as their disadvantage. And debates about authority and identity rarely crystallize or reach a resolution. No harm in that. Take a simple example of the ideas familiar to us all. As I stand in the queue of arrivals at Tegel Airport, I approach the desk of the border police and present my passport, a token of my identity, more precisely my identity document. The official uses his or her authority to approve, in very rare cases now by applying a stamp, approve my entry over the national boundary into Germany. This process, familiar to all of us, presents our terms in the most reduced and narrowed format. My passport confirms who I am within the context of nationality, Staatsangehörigkeit. The official has the authority to admit me or reject me, but the scope of both identity and authority is well defined, but extremely limited. Contrast this with the definitions at the opposite extreme. Personal identity can be said to be entailed in one's entire life experience, the things one has done and suffered, thought and felt, as well as the relationships one has created with peoples, institutions, societies. All these make a person what he or her is, he or she is. And authority is any expression of superiority, divine, paternal, of the state, of a tyrant, which enables one person or a collective to impose its wishes on another based on persuasion, violence, or simply traditional habits of obedience. At the very least, this tells us that all hierarchies are activated by the notion of authority. Terms have a wide usage, and we need to be clear how we apply them in any particular argument. In what follows, I'm going to talk about two aspects of Christian authority, as I understand it, respectively from a top-down and a bottom-up perspective, which may help to explain the comprehensive spread of Christianity in Phrygia, and then conclude with some thoughts about Christian identity in the Phrygian context, which I argue throws some light on the nature of our evidence and what that evidence is actually trying to tell us. As I reflect on what I've written, not a lot of this is entirely new. My first example is going to present some very new information from Laodicea, which Ulrich Huttner and I had the privilege of experiencing at first hand in a visit earlier this year to a conference on late antiquity there. In the second section, which considers the question of bottom-up authority, I realized after I'd written the pages for this lecture that I was basically repeating arguments that I'd put forward in Anatolia 25 years ago, and if you disagreed with me then, you won't be any more convinced now. And the third aspect on identity is the subject, in fact, of a lecture that I've developed in three other locations over the last 12 months or so in Oxford, Munich and Paris, respectively, and I apologise to those any hearers here who attended one of those lectures because they're going to hear a rather similar message. However, I haven't come up with any better ideas than I did for those, so I thought I might as well repeat them. Okay, let's start with my first example, which is look at authority rather from a top-down perspective in the Phrygian context. Among the early Christians of Phrygia, there are perhaps two main questions revolving around authority. One is simply to try and establish who the leading Christians were by virtue of their office, social status, and wider influence. However, this is clearly secondary to the crucial question: what aspects of Christian behaviour or belief had such authority, not only among Christians but in the rest of the population, that by the early 4th century, Christians became what T.D. Barnes once called the dynamic element in Roman society. Of course, he's a partial witness to this, but so that by 300, no emperor could rule securely without the acquiescence of his Christian subjects. So a certain sort of political form of authority is in question here, linked to Christianity. What caused Christianity to replace most other forms of religious activity by the end of the 4th century, and in Phrygia, I believe, at a much earlier date? As the religious change was so comprehensive and effective, we should be wary of oversimplified answers. The Christianization of Phrygia between the 2nd and the 4th century will have had multiple causes and impulses. Phrygia was never a region that was in the political spotlight, and this makes it improbable, in my view, that top-down political influence played a big or decisive part in changing its religious outlook. Nevertheless, recent discoveries at Laodicea, which was capital of the province of Phrygia in the Tetrarchic period, show that Constantine's politico-religious agenda left a mark, at least in this major provincial city. During the time of the Tetrarchy, Laodicea emerged as the metropolis of a new single province, Phrygia. In recent years, the Turkish excavators at the site have identified and now impressively restored the main buildings of the city centre. They comprise a temple, probably of Antonine date, which stands on a podium, you can see it in the picture here, at the northeast side of a colonnaded square, comprising an entire insular block along the main street in the city centre. Subsequently, a large basilica church was built, again occupying an entire insular block, one row back from the main street, directly to the east of the imperial sanctuary, or the temple, which I've just shown you. New epigraphic discoveries have cast light on the politico-religious significance of these buildings. One of the Tetrarchic governors of Phrygia, Septimius Dionysius, supervised the erection of a pair of statues personifying the people and council of Laodicea, and respectively put up by their counterparts. That is to say, the people puts up a statue of the council and the council puts up a statue of the personified Deimos. And these stood on either side of the stairway the projections of the anti on either side of the stairway leading up to the temple building. A slightly later inscription, rather intriguingly known not from the inscription itself, which doesn't survive, but from the imprint that the stone left in the mud in which it was embedded and was duly and carefully recovered by the excavators, consists of a four-line votive poem for Artemis, dedicated by another governor of the province, a man called Discolius. Discolius has been identified as a pupil of the philosopher Iamblichus and held official positions in the East under the emperor Licinius. These texts corroborate the view that the temple served as the civic imperial centre of Laodicea in the late 3rd and early 4th centuries, and that it retained its pagan associations. These buildings and monuments combined the normative civic pagan ethos of the 2nd and 3rd centuries with some of the new forms of pagan religious expression favoured by Diocletian and his fellow rulers. Another remarkable discovery is of two apparently freestanding columns carrying inscriptions and sculptured reliefs and topped by Corinthian capitals. Both columns carry Latin texts with the, this is one, Apollinis Sacrum, sacred to Apollo, Votis 20, and Fortunae Sacrum. They mark, therefore, the 20 years of the Diocletianic Tetrarchy that celebrated in major style in Rome by the emperors in 305, and these are obviously contemporaneous dedications in the provincial capital. So the counterpart of the celebrations in Rome here echoed in the provinces. And the columns carry pagan Latin dedications, one, as you can see, to Apollo and Fortuna, the other to Diana, Artemis, and the city goddess of Laodicea. Both columns were found in a vaulted crypt beneath the imperial temple. My bad photographs are because we are standing on a glass pavement through which you can look into this basement and see the columns lying more or less in their original find spot by the excavators. The excavators suggest that they'd collapsed into this underground location when the temple was damaged in a late 4th century earthquake. I think this is unlikely. The columns are virtually undamaged, and it's hard to see how they could have reached their find spots by accident. They look to me as if they've been put there and not collapsed there. And that is my hypothesis. I'd argue that they were deliberately dismounted and then concealed from public view, but not destroyed, as a result of the religious change that marked the transfer of power from Licinius to Constantine in the East after the former's defeat in 324. The cause of offence would not have been that they honoured the former regime, that the Tetrarchy was not disowned by Constantine, but that they were conspicuously pagan. And so their removal appears to mark a moment of religious change. This change is also apparent in two other new features in this city centre site. The first is the construction of a small apsed chapel precisely in the northwest portico of the imperial sanctuary. This is the photograph that I was able to take when we made our topoi visit to Laodicea in 2013. The chapel had been excavated but was still under wraps, as it were. And subsequently, it's now been unveiled and restored with a protective course to protect the walls from further damage. The chapel is dated, I take the excavator's word for this, by the find of a Constantinian coin of the period 325 to 330 found on the floor of the building itself and therefore apparently contemporaneous with the usage of this chapel. This is the first Christian intrusion into this civic imperial space. This was a world which changed when Constantine took control of the Eastern Empire that had been ruled by Licinius. And this is the first I wouldn't say tentative, but at any rate not over-assertive move to reshape the public religious environment into one that was Christian. The construction of this small chapel is a sort of statement of intent. At around the same time, if my reading of the fine context is reasonable, the pagan monuments celebrating 20 years of the Tetrarchy were demounted but not destroyed. Constantine's officials were showing at least some respect for the sensibilities of their pagan subjects. Clementia was one of the watchwords of Constantine's political propaganda in 324-5, as he sought the support, and largely won the support, of Licinius's high-level supporters in the eastern provinces. The major change came a generation later with the construction of a large church on the insula which lay one row behind and one row east of the temple in Laodicea's grid layout. This was a large rectangular church building. I think the roughly sort of square layout is dictated by the fact that it fits into a Hellenistic insular block and was intended to do so, broader than the usual basilica, with a narthex, three aisles, chambers on either side of these, and a baptisterion. There's certainly more than one phase to the building. A later phase includes a very fine non-figural mosaic with donor inscriptions, but that's laid above an original floor of opus sectile. The later phase may belong to the 5th or even the 6th century, but the excavators have suggested a 4th century, even they hazard a Constantinian date for the original foundation. Constantinian seems to me too early. The coin finds that they tabulate contain between 1 and 3 fine coins of all the early emperors up to Constantine from Augustus onwards, and then 14 of Constantius II, and comparably sort of teens numbers for the later 4th century and subsequent emperors. And that seems to me to point to a construction in the mid-4th century. It is still one of the this is the earliest monumental church that has yet been excavated in Asia Minor. The excavators plausibly hypothesize that the church was built on the occasion of the 4th century Council of Laodicea, which has been variously dated between the 340s and the 380s. For my purposes, what it seems to do is it marks the moment at which Christianity became a dominant physical presence in the heart of the city for the first time. This little case study provides, as far as I know, the only clearly documented example of the promotion of Christianity in Phrygia by the actions of a top-down authority. The changes that can be observed in Laodicea, the provincial capital, in the first half of the 4th century can be explained as the response of city authorities, magistrates and so forth, and provincial governors to imperial policies. And we can identify three main stages. First, the new form of pagan ideology promoted by the Tetrarchs. Second, the political change of regime from Licinius to Constantine in immediately after 324, in which Christianity unmistakably supplanted pagan cult as a state religion, but respect was still paid to pagan beliefs and institutions. And third, a much more decisive assertion of Christianity, perhaps driven by the powerful church leaders who convened the Council of Laodicea, acting evidently with the full support of Constantius, Constantine's successor in the East, leading to the construction of a major church, which virtually replaced the imperial temple in Laodicea's civic centre. And if you want to generalise that pattern a little bit, if you look at the pattern of church building in the 4th century, almost all the major councils at the major imperial centres are accompanied by church building, so Antioch 343, Ankara 358, St. Peter's in Rome, dare I guess, in around about 350, there's this move to monumentalize Christian architecture in the mid-4th century, which I think is coming from a combined impetus, both from imperial policy, Constantius reinforcing, although of course with slightly different doctrinal emphasis, the impetus given by Constantine, but also, above all, supported by the ever-increasing power of politicized bishops with the ability to transform their influence into real, you know, really make a difference in the way that these cities looked and worked. However, I'll stop there. Any questions? That's my first third.
Sorry, yeah. Just a clarification on the chapel building, unless I missed that, what determines it to be a chapel? Is that the layout? And where exactly, again, is it within the city? Is it by
the Agora? No, it's exactly in the Agora, between a couple of the columns at the side of one of the stoas at the edge of the Agora. It's orientated as a church should be. It has an apse in the appropriate position. So in terms of form and function, it appears to be a small chapel placed right in the city centre.
Size, 10 metres long?
No, much smaller, 6 metres long. Five metres even.
Where's the target of publication?
The inscriptions are is it Francesco Guizzi from, he works on the Hierapolis inscriptions, but the... it's the Italian team in Hierapolis.
So would you say that the chapel is just a symbol because it's so small, or is the number of Christians still so small?
I don't think we can correlate it to the number of Christians. It's a building that's put up, it appears, if the dating evidence is good, immediately afterwards. How intrusive it was seen. I mean, I'm arguing that maybe they took down the pagan columns and they put this little chapel in straight away. It's an unanswerable question how far that involves a desacralization of the pagan civic space. But it certainly marks a step towards its Christianization.
Could you put the chapel about then almost 50 years or 40 years before the
big church?
The church, and why there on the Agora? Couldn't it have been connected with some kind of material or whatever?
Well, we have no evidence for a martyrion in the city centre. Ulrich might be able to correct me on that, but I'm not aware that there is. I think the point about the position is precisely, it's like countermarking a coin. You know, when you've got a coin issued by the previous regime that's now out of favour and you put your own stamp on it with a new head to say, you know, we've got a new regime here. And putting this little chapel, I mean, it couldn't serve the purpose of a congregation. You know, you get three people praying in it and it would be crowded. But it sends a very clear message.
So on that note, so would there be a possible replacement of a new hill or a place where you might have had previously hill, where the chapel would have sort of replaced that Coptic environment?
We don't know what the temple... I thought the temple, in fact, the excavators described the temple as an imperial temple. I don't think there's any evidence for that. Given the dedication, it looks as if Artemis and Apollo are the two pagan divinities most closely associated with it. So it might just as well be a temple of Artemis and Apollo. But... I said, you know, this is normative civic paganism of the period. I don't know, that's a sort of shorthand expression for something we find in these city centres all over, where the mixture of sort of imperial cult and, you know, the Olympian deities and so on and so forth, sort of they fuse in a sort of Reibungslos with one another. And in this case, we don't yet have a dedicatory inscription or a building inscription from the temple, and one may turn up.
Also in der späteren Zeit gibt es ja sehr oft Fälle, wo kleinere Kapellen einfach mitten in antike Strukturen reingebaut wurden, die dann so wie in dem Beispiel eben auch quer zu einer Treppe sein können oder sowas. Aber haben Sie auch andere Beispiele von so kleinen Kapellen, die mitten in irgendeine, also sowas Zentrales, in Agora eingebaut sind und dabei eben die restliche Struktur so überhaupt nicht berücksichtigen?
Ja, ich habe nicht für Parallele gesucht. Als ich rumspaziert bin und mit dem Leiter der Ausgrabung gesprochen habe, lag es mehr oder weniger auf der Hand, dass das, was so etwas passiert hatte, dass dieses kleine Kapelle wurde mittendrin in dem Agora eingebaut. Natürlich haben sie die Gelegenheit hier in Laodikia ein Staatszentrum zu erforschen, das nicht mehr möglich in anderen Zentren ist. Aber ja, man muss nachschauen, vielleicht gibt es Parallele dafür. Level.
So we have to. There must have been a building since the Council of Nicaea for a synod for the province.
But the answer to that question, I suppose, could take two forms. I mean, there should, according to the Nicaea, there should be a synod, a provincial synod every year, which involved simply the bishops of the immediate province. Those were clearly meant to be fairly routine occasions, but it's possible that it was sufficiently important for the clergy at Laodicea, the bishops of Phrygia, were sufficiently influential to be able immediately to have a big church erected to serve their annual meetings. We don't know where these meetings took place. There's absolutely no evidence in the sources for where these synods took place, presumably in a church of some sort, but it seems to me that the dating evidence for the coins does point to a mid 4th century date, and that falls within the brackets around for the Council of Laodicea. I've always been inclined, but not for any compelling reasons, to date the Council of Laodicea relatively early, sort of in the 350s rather than the 380 period. But so it's, you know, we're still at a fairly hypothetical level, but I think it's a good hypothesis.
Yeah, I was wondering whether you can kindly elaborate a bit on the Tetrarchic column as to its wider context, whether it sort of despite it legitimizes the hypothesis that a monument along the lines of the Bucanalia in the form of Rome existed in actuality.
I think I'd rather not answer that question with an eye on the clock. I mean, there is a pretty large literature on this Tetrarchic propagandistic building in major cities of the East, as well as, of course, the Roman example. And that provides the material, I think, to sort of develop an answer to that question. Let me go on. I would say that neither city centre paganism nor city centre Christianity defined the religious mentality, still less the religious identity, of a Roman provincial population. And the state's ability to impose new religious ideas or norms on its subjects was necessarily limited, if only because the state tends to operate within urban structures and in a province like Phrygia, where probably 90% of the population lived outside the city, the impact of such measures was limited. And so just switching the line of argument, I want to suggest that the conversion of Phrygia to Christianity is very unlikely to be mainly the result of top-down political changes like the one I've sketched. Especially in a rural province, we need to look for more bottom-up explanations of religious change. And what I understand by that is that Christianity must have supplied a form of religious experience which proved more powerful and effective in some way with what was previously available, whether as a ritual or as a communal social movement, as a psychological experience, or more mundanely at an institutional and organisational level. Well, the confrontation in Central Asia Minor is with a world which I sort of tried to sketch in my Anatolia book, which is why I go back here. The examples I show you are just a couple of really randomly selected. That's Maine on the left, a Poseidon relief on the right. These are both, in fact, not from Phrygia at all. They're from Lycaonia. This is Konya. I'm afraid my digital slides are all of Lycaonia recently. I haven't, my Phrygian ones are all in old-fashioned slide form, and I haven't got them in a form I can show you here. They're local cults of Zeus as a weather or agricultural god, of the mother goddess, accompanied by wild animals, but rarely transformed into Artemis. The Phrygian gods of justice, the Iranian Anatolian deity Maine. Sometimes these cults were, that's another example, these are the rider gods of northern Pisidia, with a figure used to be identified as Helen between them, but is an indigenous deity. Again, not really Phrygian, we're on the southern borders of Phrygia here. Some of these cults were introduced into the cities, but there actually is, I think, quite a difference between sort of civic paganism with temples and statues a la Grec and so forth, corresponding with the pictures you've seen of Laodicea, and the paganism of rural sanctuaries, which tend not to be known from archaeological, but simply from the evidence of their reliefs. This particular text, I don't want to discuss it in detail, but is actually a relatively rare example from Konya, where the monumentality of the inscription suggests this comes from an urban building. It's probably part of a block from a temple. But the gods who are here being honoured are a row of very Anatolian-looking gods who've been brought into the city centre, the Theoi Soteres, Andistis, the Phrygian, one of the Phrygian, three sorts of mother goddess, as well as Apollo and Artemis. Now, it's plausible to think that there were sufficient similarities between regional paganism and early forms of organized Christianity for the transition from one to the other to have been relatively easy. A good deal of attention has been paid to the potential correspondence between pagan Phrygian cults, including those that involved prophecy, spirit possession, and other ecstatic elements, including cults of Attis, Angdistis, and the mother goddess, and similar elements in Phrygian Christianity, notably Montanism, where spirit possession, especially among inspired women, priests and prophetesses, was one of the sect's defining elements. However, modernism demanded extraordinary levels of religious commitment, was certainly not a natural choice for many men and women, and I doubt whether pagan-Christian correspondence at this rather rarefied level could have had a wide impact on the majority of the population. So I'm inclined not to foreground the similarities between ecstatic forms of Phrygian paganism and ecstatic elements in Phrygian Christianity and say that that is the sort of route of transmission by which the area became, as it were, infected by the new religious belief. I think a more powerful case can be made for similarities between other forms of pagan belief and Judeo-Christian monotheism. I've written at no doubt excessive length about Theos Hypsistos and argued that the cult of the highest god, which was deeply embedded in Phrygia as well as in other parts of Asia Minor and the East Mediterranean, is a sort of an iconic abstract divinity, and it shared common religious ground with the classic monotheisms. This is, I simply don't have the right illustrations, so this is simply a provocative picture of a apparently hybrid type of, or you know, a very hard to classify form of religious dedication, an iconic. You think it's a menorah. The only publication of this monument suggests that this is Jewish and is a menorah, but it's not a menorah. But if you ask me what it is, I couldn't tell you, except to say that I don't feel uncomfortable with this monument. This comes from the south coast of Asia Minor, but one could parallel it in other areas as something which doesn't fit our conventional classifications, but belongs to, you know, what I've talked about as a sort of common ground. It's also apparent that Phrygian cults of holiness and justice, Hosion kai Dikaion, offered a notion of divine justice with parallels in especially Old Testament thought. And this is also represented by the rich body of confession inscriptions of Lydia and southwest Phrygia, which provide numerous case studies concerning offences against morality, as well as what we might think of as criminal behaviour, which were dealt with by the mechanisms of divine justice. It's not difficult, and many people have attempted to do so in various ways, to identify points of contact in this material with Jewish and Christian belief and action, and speculate about how and in what circumstances these systems might have come into contact with one another. Such parallels between Phrygian paganism and Judeo-Christian beliefs have been widely noted, but I think are still insufficient to explain why ordinary people changed their religious allegiance. Another starting point is to look not at the religious implications of monuments like this and others, but at the society which held these beliefs or which thought it worthwhile to put up monuments like this. Some years ago, Peter van Nuffelen showed that the well-known letter to Arsacius, high priest of Galatia, of Julian, Epistle 84, Bides, should probably be viewed as an early 5th century fake. I regret that deeply because it removes one of the props of my argument, but it's the letter in which Julian spells out in his own words, as it were, or perhaps not his own words, the three crucial ways in which the Christian community had the advantage of pagan rivals. And I think they're worth applying to the regional context of rural Anatolia. The writer of the letter observed, "Why do we not observe that it is their benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness, semnotes, of their lives that have done most to increase atheism?" So the Christians show these particular qualities. Now, if that is the genuine sort of expression of Julian's observation, it's actually terrifically valuable. And unfortunately, it isn't, if Mafan Naphalan is right. So I would have to elaborate this argument over several pages, drawing on several other letters and statements of Julian to reconstruct the same picture. However, I'm going to take it as giving me a guide into what I want to say, namely that these generalizations about the benevolence of Christians to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the holiness with which they conduct their lives, their semnotes, do have a particular resonance in this sort of society. By unplanned, my next slide is a document we have already been heard about this morning from Christiana Zimmermann. Again, I'm afraid from Lycaonia, but I could replicate this with several Christian Phrygian parallels. This is the gravestone of Aurelia Nonni from Gdanmar. In fact, you can classify Gdanmar as virtually Phrygian if you want. It's on the sort of Phrygian area of Lycaonia. The Christian responsibility to care for those in need, guests and strangers, the poor, the elderly, widows and orphans, is of course a commonplace of Christians' own literature, emphasised from the Gospels onwards. Charitable support for the poor, a central characteristic of their communities. And that, it seems to me, is fully borne out by the Christian epitaphs from Anatolia. And in this respect, I think this is one point where the Christian epitaphs do seem to me to take a step beyond the sort of general traditions of which one finds in the epitaphs, that the emphasis on charity and almsgiving is very much part of Christian self-representation. Another peculiarity of Phrygian grave monuments is that they were designed for large intergenerational families stretching across three or four generations, including not only parents and siblings, but also cousins, in-laws. In fact, a generally rather sort of generalized Bruderschaft, if you like, where it's sometimes quite difficult to work out what the actual relations between the persons who were buried in the tomb were. This is something that Peter Toneman, who's been mentioned several times, has discussed illuminatingly in a recent paper. And that is in a marked contrast with the normal nuclear family structures that are found in most grave inscriptions from Greco-Roman cities. So I would just hazard that the Christian injunction to those able to do so, that they should take care of the brothers and sisters in the Christian community, actually echoed the practice of these large Christian Phrygian families that apparently are taking care of and seeing themselves already as part of an enlarged family community, much more so than is apparent in funerary epigraphy elsewhere. Christian care for the dead, also singled out by Julian, may also have spoken directly to many Christians. The text here is one of the Upper Tembris Valley Phrygian tombstones, and from the sort of mid-third century, and among other things, demonstrates the spread of the family. There are a lot of people mentioned in this text. To judge from the elaboration of their grave monuments, obvious here, the common people of Phrygia invested much more in their burials than most other rural or urban populations. The sanctity of their graves was protected by elaborate curses, and the curse formulae range across a spectrum from pagan to explicitly Christian. And of course, in this respect, the Christians of Phrygia who were using the famous Eumenaean or other formulas were adapting a local tradition which invoked pagan deities for the same purpose, to protect their tombs from interference. Moreover, Phrygian tombstones were highly decorated with representations of the deceased family members, as well as with the tools and ornaments of their everyday life. In other words, the tomb itself secured a visible and idealized afterlife for its members. The Christian notion that death was merely the moment of repose before resurrection, which is explicitly articulated in the grave formula of the 3rd century, is a sort of intensification of the concept that there was life, indeed a blessed life, after death. Precisely that was portrayed in a figurative way in Phrygian tomb reliefs. And finally, Phrygian holiness, which can be personified in the cult of Hosion Kaidikaion, is a counterpart, perhaps a forerunner, perhaps a competitor, with the holiness of Christian lives and conduct on which Julian, or the writer of the letter to Arsacius at any rate, remarked. Louis Robert long ago quoted the passage from Socrates' Ecclesiastical History, in which he explains the success of novation Christianity among the Phrygians, saying that the Phrygians are more temperate than other nations. They're seldom guilty of swearing. They are not addicted to sensual pleasures. And it's for these reasons, he says, that novationism made such headway, an ascetic Christian sect. So in fact, he makes the argument very clearly that I would wish to support, that this was a form of Christianity that fell on fertile ground. So to summarize, I simply argue, as I argued a long time ago, that the traditional values of Phrygian and family and social life, as well as specific aspects of their religious belief, were sufficiently close to the ideals represented by early Christianity that when the latter were propagated as a central part of Christian doctrine, they soon found many followers and adherents. Christianity's message gave it real traction from the bottom up and led to its rapid adoption. The intrinsic message of Christianity promised resurrection and a blessed and eternal life to those who lived holy and just lives and undertook charitable works to support the poor. And this had a particular persuasive authority among the Christians of Phrygia, precisely because it corresponded with virtues and traditions of conduct which were already prized there. The message fell on receptive ears. So that's my version of an argument which I've put forward before, and I'll stop there if there's comments or questions. I think it's a huge topic, and it certainly hasn't been explored in sort of with the sophistication that is required to sort of untangle this rather anthropological evidence. I mean, there are two articles that I know, one by you know two of the outstanding young scholars in this field, Peter Toneman and remind me his name, the Frenchman, who Destefan, and they both written articles on the sort of family structures in these Anatolian epitaphs. Toneman is very cautious. He says, of course, we can't infer that just because people are represented on a tomb as a sort of interlocking unity, as a family, that we can necessarily think that they all lived in large households or that entity existed in daily life. He's more cautious than I would be. I would have thought there is likely to be a correspondence between them. I suppose it's just a notion I have that, you know, we've already talked about had the difficulty in some of these inscriptions of deciding whether brothers who appear or are actually real brothers, or whether they're figurative brothers in the Christian sense. And then you look at these Phrygian inscriptions and you find relatives, and it's not entirely clear whether they're in-laws or cousins or how the relationship works, and some of the terminology looks as if it gets used rather approximately. And so it seems to me that there may be a sort of convergence of those two sort of ideas, and obviously the Christian, you know, the early Christian literature talks about people where Verwandtschaft, in the sense of actually being related to one another, is clearly less important than belonging to the community. So I don't know, it's a line that I thought I would try and follow when I dig a bit deeper into the Phrygian material in detail and see if it does actually work as a correspondence point between the social structures and the new religious structures, social structures that are applied to them. So do I think that the fact that you have those religious associations in Phrygia and Lydia would be because they fit well with, you know, the Christian? I think people change religions for, I don't think that's the sort of reason that would make whole populations, you know, change their religious outlook pretty fundamentally. The fact that there were organizational similarities between, say, as you know, Trajan implies that, or Pliny's letter implies, doesn't it, that a heteria, a Christian group, could be interpreted as a heteria, and so that they must have been broadly similar. But I mean, yes, that is definitely a point where paganism and Christianity obviously touch and overlap with one another, but I'm not sure that I want to identify it as one which had a particularly strong influence and persuaded people to move from one system to another. It doesn't offer that explanation. It just says they're similar.
Yeah. Some more, you know. So it does, the more you do that, the more it makes the switch somewhat hard to understand.
I agree. I don't think that what I've said offers an explanation. I mean, I think it offers something, a context, which I think is important, but why switch? Exactly. Unless, you know, the sociological argument is valid, namely that you can see that Christian communities do better when they look after their widows and their poor, that it just works better in social terms and people are persuaded of that. I mean, you could say intrinsically what the Christians do has a persuasive force that brings people over. So they're not, because they're not identical, clearly, and that's, and those, and you know, that's why I picked on those three things that pseudo-Julian, as it were, picks out as reasons where observed that the Christians do things better than the pagans and therefore could offer an explanation.
I wonder whether we're necessarily in the danger of working with a model that assumes that conversion is out of A into B.
Mm.
Yeah. Whereas if one has a slightly more biological model, then one might also ask whether Christianity in Phrygia learnt from and adopted characteristics of I mean, some of the things that you've drawn attention to, like care for poor, etc., are not the only characters of Christianity. You have identified the ones which you already find in Fridger.
Yeah.
Well, one could start from a different profile of Christianity and say, well, it's not like Fridger comes at all. So I wonder whether one could have an argument that actually, picking up some of the things we've been talking about today, that Fridger in its that Christianity in its local manifestations also learns from.
Yep.
Local cultural practices, and therefore, and also in the light of some of the things you've said about hybrid, the difficulty of tying down whether an inscription is Jewish, Christian, Theosophist, or something. Is that our problem, or is it a problem of the people concerned? What one might have a model of emergence.
Yep.
Rather than of conversion.
Yes, I'm.
You know, emergence are out of common, out of shared characteristics.
Yes,
darkness to light.
Yes, and there is a danger in all this of being very teleological, and you know what the end result is going to be, and it's the 5th century, and you assume that all the current is going one way, and then you find explanations to explain why water runs downhill, and you haven't really got very far. I entirely take that point And in fact, I also wonder when we try to, when we say that, let's say that the Phrygians are noted for their sober manners, and that appears to be a reflection on something intrinsic to the Phrygians, but it may already be describing what Christianity was like in Phrygia and the influence of, even from the very early stage, because I think there's evidence that Christianity has got a biggish hold in this area from the 2nd century onwards, has on what we otherwise think of as just sort of pagan society there. So, I think sociologically it's very complicated, or reasonably complicated, and it's not overcomplicated. And I don't want to talk about conversion, which doesn't seem to me to be a very... Conversion is something that's sort of conducted by an agency, really, that persuades one to go from another, and I don't think we're dealing with that here, not in any normal sense of the word, anyway.
Stephen, what's the factors or the analogies you establish between Phrygian religion and Christianity? Isn't there another factor too? If we look at the monuments, it has Christian iconography on it, or a formula that shows that it is Christian, it always gives one the impression that it applies for all the people that are mentioned in the inscription, not only for the one who is buried or so. So it is a kind of a family affair.
Mm.
And those families, as you said, are sometimes quite large, three generations or even the extended family. What is the influence, really, just of the natural progress in life of the next generation and the next generation being multiplied or even more every 20 years?
Demography, very difficult. Yes, sure. I mean, if you've got big, powerful landed families and most of their members are Christian and they're marrying out and they're, of course, you've got a dynamic, explosive effect. It's hard to, quantification we can't really do. I have the impression, but it's something that I need to work on in this particular project, that that proportion of Christians, certain Christians in many of these communities, was much higher than is normally given credit for. I mean, texts can be identified or assigned to be Christian, but also a good many texts that don't appear to be Christian are likely to be Christian, as was point was made earlier this morning in one of the talks. I think I must proceed if I'm going to not get to near the end. as I said, despite this attempt to produce a sort of model of how Christian might have some intrinsic authority that made it work from the bottom up, I still think that this is not nearly sufficient to explain the extent to which Central Asia Minor communities not only adopted Christianity in the early centuries, but also advertised and even, as I'm going to argue, flaunted the new religion. First of all, a fact which is probably known to all of you, but is still startling, the fact that the distribution of the pre-Constantinian inscriptions of Asia Minor, 276 texts according to Destefan, I'm sure it's about 350 or 400 in fact, but that'll do, precisely seven come from coastal cities. All the rest are from the interior, mostly deep in the interior. That doesn't tell us, it tells us less about where Christians were living in pre-Constantinian Asia Minor than about the manner in which their dead were commemorated. We know that there were Christians living in the cities of Western Asia Minor from the New Testament, the letters of Ignatius, and from all the second century Christian literature, which Judith's two books have discussed in detail. And Judith's Lewes approach to those is largely through a theorizing about Christian identity, about defining, identifying, shaping the shapes of Christian identity in this period. Well, in the time remaining to me, what I want to do is to use the concept of identity in a rather different way to explain the distribution and significance of early Christian inscriptions in Anatolia, and in particular to try to answer the question why it was normal for Christians in Central Asia Minor, but almost unknown for their counterparts in the Aegean regions, to identify themselves on their monuments. And the way I'm going to do this is by calling in a very rather unexpected contemporary analogy, which is the experience of being gay or homosexual in 20th and 21st century Britain, probably in Germany and the United States as well, but I'll stick to Britain because I know it better. And what I'm going to argue is that the place of homosexuality in modern European experience provides sufficient parallels with the place of Christianity in the Eastern Roman Empire of our period to explain some of the real issues of Christian identity at this period. Let me start by explaining the nature of the analogy. Being gay, like being Christian, is both what I'd call an individual and a societal disposition. When an individual makes clear that he or she is gay, this is not simply an affirmation about one person's sexual preferences, but a statement that he or she belongs to a well-defined and distinctive segment of society. And such assertions are of both personal but also of wider cultural significance. As such, we can understand them as strong identity statements. They convey information that not only defines the individual, but helps to sharpen understanding of the world to which he or she belongs. Now, declaring oneself to be Christian in the Roman Empire before 270, or gay in the United Kingdom before 1960, was also a statement that involved at least nominal law-breaking. Homosexuality in the UK has progressed from being criminal and punishable by the penal code up to the early 1960s, when it was legalised, to growing social acceptability in the late 20th and 21st centuries. Indeed, legislation now points in the other direction, making it a crime to discriminate against an individual on grounds of their sexuality. However, sexuality, for the most time when it was illegal, was mostly seen as potentially criminal rather than as an active form of criminal behaviour. Homosexuality generally tolerated by state authorities, especially if discretion was observed by the by gays, but might be triggered or activated in certain situations. Most gay people, like most devout Christians, also see their homosexuality as being integral to their personal identity, although there are wide differences within the gay community about how far they make their gayness visible and known to others. There's also a broad spectrum of responses in the heterosexual community to gayness, ranging from positive approval, normally taking the form of sort of celebration of diversity, to abhorrence, However, this range of responses is by no means only a matter of individual choice. The views of whole sections of society align in predictable ways. In the UK, it remains almost impossible for high-profile practitioners of team sports to go public with their homosexuality. Conversely, within the creative cultural world, gayness encounters little opposition and may even work as a career asset. The same attitudinal split works geographically. Being gay in South Wales, where I spent most of my own career during the 1980s and 1990s, called for a lot more discretion than being gay in metropolitan London or in some other large cities. Geographical and social factors had and still have a major influence on a gay person's choices about when and where to make their gayness part of their public as well as their private identities. Now, in drawing an analogy between gayness and early Christianity, I'm not for a moment making any assertion about the substantive content of these two dispositions, but emphasizing the point that the consequence of being gay in 20th century Britain or Christian in the second century Roman Empire generated a strikingly analogous relationship between the individual and society. And thinking about it today, I mean, this same analogy, I've chosen gayness, but it could work with other similar social dispositions like, say, veiling and non-veiling among Islamic women, or colour and, you know, your sense of your blackness or whatever, taking on Laura Nasrallah's starting point of her lecture in United States. I think one could work the analogy with other parallels. Declaring oneself to be gay in the modern world or Christian in ancient Rome constitutes a primary personal identity statement with major consequences about the way in which a person is integrated into society. In both cases, going public is a major step fraught with social consequences. The essence of coming out is not primarily a psychological matter important to the individual, but a sociological one that redefines one's place in society. Establishing this new and often hazardous relationship was the key factor in determining whether and in what ways the gay person or the ancient Christian made their disposition or their belief public. Now, two recent strands of scholarly research on antiquity help me to understand the change relationship between the individual and society which was involved in becoming Christian. One of the most important points about religious mentalities in antiquity, which is crucial to understanding the social and psychological changes introduced by Christianity, has been made repeatedly in a number of studies by John North, although I'm not sure that they've been thoroughly absorbed by the sort of scholarly community that looks at Christianity rather than pagan religion. Before the later Roman period, John argues that it simply did not happen, or it only happened in quite exceptional circumstances, that a person made any declaration or pronouncement at all about his or her specific religious allegiance, whether on their gravestones or anywhere else. Stating your religious identity in the form of claiming an exclusive form of religious allegiance simply did not make sense for a person or for most people as a form of behaviour in the pagan world. A person might reveal or declare themselves to be pious, but this was not an identity statement. That was an assertion about your character. But this was no longer true for Christianity. And that's what I mean by making a strong identity statement or proposition. The other strand of research which has led to a fuller understanding of the importance of self-representation, and this is where the epigraphers come to the rescue, Selbstdarstellung, in the material and written record of antiquity, the forms of text and monument chosen for public display, and above all the public display of inscriptions, are a critical medium for seeing how individuals or groups presented their identities in public, in a public and societal context. So accordingly, inscriptions that identify their subjects as Christians take us to the centre of the question, what it meant to be a Christian in society. Now, In the paper that I wrote on Christian self-representation on Anatolian tombstones for the Berlin Epigraphy Congress, I concentrated on Phrygian inscriptions from the 2nd to 4th century, attempting to demonstrate evolving modes of expression with shifts of emphasis over those two centuries corresponding to Christianity's own changing position within wider society. The examples, and I'm not going to comment on these in detail, these are fairly familiar Phrygian monuments, two gravestones from Cardi from the sort of third quarter of the second century, up on the screen there. The examples show, in my view, that coming out as Christian was already normal in Asia Minor long before Constantine, and that putting Christian beliefs on display in 2nd and 3rd century Phrygia or Lycaonia was at least as acceptable as advertising one's gayness in London's Soho or New York's Greenwich Village in the 1970s and 1980s. None of the examples was designed to obscure the Christian identity of the tombs. One thing I hope to do with this book on Phrygian Christianity is banish the idea of crypto-Christians, who I've been campaigning against for years. The makers of these memorials wished to signify, indeed to proclaim, that they were members of the Christian community. It's also clear that the individuals and families who were identified in this way were fully accepted by wider society. This is a particularly drastic example. These are tombstones from Temenos-Thurii in northwestern Phrygia. The one on the left for a bishop, labelled loud and clear with a cross in the top. Another one for a member of a lay family with a cross within a sort of a crown. It's the sort of Victoria, the cross victorious on what looks like a Eucharistic table. The high quality composite door stones of Phrygian Temenos-Thurii around AD 200, just like the splendid stelae of the Upper Tembris Valley two generations later, Christians for Christians texts, must have been on display in the main cemeteries of these communities, were designed for some of its wealthiest inhabitants. The Christians in these areas took conspicuous pride, not in this form of self-representation, but also in their clerical titles, as Sabina Hübner's work has shown in particular, where she's demonstrated how not only do the gravestones of priests, deacons, bishops in villages and towns and so forth all over central Anatolia advertise for this fact, but the clerical titles were treated themselves as a significant badge of status throughout the 3rd century. So to return to the analogy with the recent history of homosexuality, Christians, I would argue, made as much a show of their beliefs as the parade of lesbian and gay culture and identity at gay pride marches and festivals, and is in fact designed essentially to serve the same purpose, to make this form of identity not only normative and acceptable, but also to project it as to project it as normative. The public advertisement of Christianity is significant not only as an act of epigraphic Selbstdarstellung, but also feeds back into John North's argument about the changing nature of religious identity in the Roman Empire. As is well known, the central transaction in the relatively rare criminal trials of Christians before Roman officials was the accused's proud and courageous preface to condemnation and martyrdom, namely that I am a Christian, Christianus sum. Thus, the crime of religious identity, of acknowledging the nomen Christianum, became a central feature of Christian self-assertion. Public martyrdom was happily an unusual occurrence, but the rite and commemoration of burial presented all Christians, at the moment of their earthly demise, with the precise opportunity to assert their new place in the new, their place in the new Christian society. In reality, the assertion of Christian identity on countless Phrygian and Lycaonian tombstones in the 2nd and 3rd century confirmed their legitimacy and their prominence in the world. It also placed the owners of these tombs at the beginning of a process which separates the mental world of late antiquity from that of the early Roman Empire, namely attachment to a particular religion or religious movement now becomes a central part of an individual's identity. Religious acts become identity statements. The current standing of homosexuality in much, not all, of the UK and Western Europe is the outcome of what is rather loosely characterised as a culture war. Coming out, self-assertion and self-representation have caused major shifts in societal attitudes through the second half of the 20th century. The timescale of this change, roughly spanning my own lifetime between the mid-20th century and the present day, is not dissimilar to the timescale of growing Christian acceptability in the 3rd century, say between about 180 and 250 AD. But this acceptance is not universal and has been heavily dependent on pre-existing, on the composition and attitudes of the community where gay culture has tried to make headway. Comparably, the explanation of the dramatic contrast between Inner Anatolia, where Christianity made such conspicuous public progress, and the coastal regions where Christians didn't show their face, is as much to be sought in the nature of the non-Christian population as it is to be sought in the analogy in the non-gay population. The analogy therefore requires the second part of my argument, that the social and religious environment of Inner Anatolia was potentially receptive to Christianity in a manner and to a degree which was sufficiently different from that of the coastal areas or the long Hellenized regions of the West and South to lead to these very different forms and choices about self-representation. And I, in the earlier part of the lecture, I've tried to sketch out a case for this. The society of Inner Anatolia was rooted in the countryside with an organisation of villages and landed estates. The institutions and organisation of Greek-style polis only made a superficial impact in this area. The religious culture of Inner Anatolia likewise was very different from that of major Greek or Roman cities, which were dominated by temples, priesthoods and institutions which were completely aligned with secular state institutions such as those of the Roman Empire or of established and effective Greek cities. The thriving religious culture of inner rural Anatolia looks quite different. An obvious point to make about Asia Minor's pagan rural cults is that the sheer number of dedications and monuments that they generated, religious votives feature in the epigraphy of almost every village in Anatolia. These communities were accustomed to showing off their devotion, even if not necessarily through a personal identity statement. But this in itself established a favourable climate for advertising an individual's religiosity of whatever character, including Christian belief. Christianity, I'm arguing as a final point, had little difficulty in asserting its presence in this environment and made rapid and public headway over the course of the second and third centuries. And from the beginning of this process, around 150, it becomes visible to us. The inscriptions demonstrate that this was achieved through pride and self-assertion. That's it. Thank you.